from inside the WAER studios.
Long outlet pass, Ryan Simmons inside! He scores the game winner! Give the assist to Don Mattona! Syracuse wins!
Finds Guerrier, open, drives baseline, goes up, and hammers it home! Quincy Guerrier, hello!
And it's intercepted! Andre Sisco!
Flings it from 75 feet past the scoreboard, and he connected! Elijah Hughes throws up a prayer at the buzzer, and somehow it's answered!
It's the Ostrom Avenue Podcast.
The Orange, take the Camping World Bowl.
Syracuse gets the program signature win it always needed. Perhaps the biggest upset in program history.
Taj Harris passed the 45. He's past midfield. 30, 25, 20, 15, 10, 5. Touchdown, Syracuse.
And one, Joe Girard.
Three ball, Buddy Boeheim. He got all three of them. Huge shot from Buddy.
Pass point, Black got it. Game winner. Brendan Curry with the winner.
Hughes left wing charges and slams with the right hand.
Killing a three at the buzzer. Oh, it's good.
And here's your hosts, Owen Valentine and Ben Shulman.
Welcome into the Ostrom Avenue Podcast. It has been a two-plus week long basketball hiatus, but we are back. Syracuse basketball is back, and it feels like we open up every episode at this point with something is back, and that's just been, you know, the narrative of the last 10 or so months. Something is back at every point in time. And this week, for the second time this season, Syracuse basketball is back. They take on Pitt tomorrow at 4:30, 4 o'clock countdown to tip off over at WAER.org or 88.3 FM for those who want to listen over on the radio. Ben, there are a lot of narratives to talk about because you've got some mix-ups, obviously. You're coming off your second full quarantine of the 2020-2021 season for Syracuse basketball. And if your name is Buddy Boeheim, you've spent, I think it's like 37 of the last 48 days to what we know in quarantine. That has had to be a miserable stretch. But fortunately for him, his quarantine includes a basketball court, so it could be worse. But when you look at this team, you've got, you know, you come off the second full quarantine, but unlike the opponent tomorrow in Pitt, you've got your whole lineup for the first time since game one this year. Barama Sidibe is back, which means that we've got some discussions to have. And we started that over at our Twitter yesterday at Ostrom Avenue Pod, talking about who should the starting lineup be? What should the starting lineup be? Ben and I having a little fun because obviously Jim Boeheim is not necessarily going to play what the starting lineup should be, but we gave our takes, and I think that's a good starting point to sort of continue that discussion today as we got a little input from some listeners, some on Twitter, some just hitting up our phone lines and texting us their takes and how wrong we are and how bold Ben was. And so we'll sort of start on that narrative. With Barama Sidibe back, coming off the two-week quarantine, you've got your whole lineup and endless opportunities. What's your starting lineup?
I'll say, I went for a bold take, as I'm about to show, and I got a lot of support. I think people liked it, which I was a bit surprised about. So I have, as I said on our not last episode, because last episode was the top five crossover of the last century, but the episode before that, what I had Kadari Richmond at the one, Alan Griffin at the two, Quincy Guerrier at the three, Marek Dolezal at the four, and Barama Sidibe at the five. And it's, you know, it's a big shakeup. I think it's a lot different than most people think it's going to go or would want it to go, because you're pulling out the two guys who were expected to lead this team, Girard and Boeheim, coming into the season. Someone tweeted at me, which I appreciated, saying, where's the shooting going to come from? Which is a completely valid question. And I think I should address that on the pod. I think Alan Griffin, this is putting a lot of weight on him in my starting lineup. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. He's supposed to be able to hit a lot of shots. So I think that's something he can do. I think we need to start thinking about Quincy Guerrier as somewhat of a three-point shooter. And I think that Girard and Boeheim are still a part of this team with my starting lineup. I think that Boeheim can come off the bench. Girard can come off the bench. If one of them is hot, great. play him for 32, 33 minutes. You don't have to play Kadari or Allen as much. You know, we just haven't seen a game this year, I think, where Kadari, Allen, Joe, and Buddy are all on. So I think guys will work their way into the lineup in the first half of the game. And by the second half, you'll know who the best five are to play out there for the final 20 minutes.
Yeah, Ben, we've got pretty drastically different looks in terms of our starting lineups. And I think that sort of is the narrative right now, that there are so many different opportunities that you can have and different looks at this lineup that you can have. And there are so many things that you can shake up, and that's going to be pretty present as I give a drastically different look than what you did. I want to revert back to game one when Syracuse came out against Bryant. And obviously it was a short-lived look as Barama Sidibe goes down relatively early in that game. And so you've had this altered look since then. But I want to go back to day one. I want to go back to Joe Girard at the one, as controversial as that is, Buddy at the two, Quincy at the three, Marek at the four, and Barama at the five. And before the world goes berserk on me, as Kevin Kloss did yesterday on Twitter, Alan Griffin, I want you to turn him in to Deion Waiters. Take it back to 2011, 2012, where Deion Waiters just is that guy. The only thing is he is coming off the bench. I think that is such a valuable thing for him to be able to come off the bench. It's a role that he's very experienced in. And I am not saying to cut his minutes at any way, shape, or form, but I'm thinking if maybe the first 4 or 5 minutes of this game, you sort of start with that different look and then you throw him in there. Say it's for Joe because Joe is struggling. Say Buddy's struggling. Say, Marek gets into foul trouble. Quincy gets into foul trouble. Even if Dolezal is struggling, he is option number one. If any of your starting five are struggling early on or get into foul trouble in the early going, it's such a valuable piece and such a good piece that I think they can work with and I think he can work with. And so if you can sort of turn him into that Deion Waiters sixth man role to then, inevitably in Deion's case become a top 10 pick in the NBA draft, but maybe that's not the case for Alan Griffin, but I think it's such a good opportunity for Syracuse to have him come in and still play 30 minutes a game. But for him, he's going to start on the bench and sort of just see where things take you and see where the game takes you. That's the coolest thing about this time you've had without Barama, is you've sort of seen this opportunity for Syracuse that Alan Griffin can sort of come in and you can alter your lineup to fit every different spot. If Joe comes out, then you shift Buddy to the one, or you put Alan Griffin at the one. If Buddy comes out, you put Allen at the two. If Quincy comes out, Allen plays the three. If Marek comes out, Allen plays the three. Quincy plays the four. And if Sidibe comes out, Quincy plays the four and Dolezal plays the five. You can put him into any one of these starting spots. Like if you pull any of these starters, it'll work. And I think we're both on the same page here. There's a lot of value in at least trying to start games with Barama Sidibe at the five.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that I haven't been the largest Sidibe supporter. You're kind of the resident Sidibe supporter.
I stand Barama Sidibe. I have for way longer than I should, and I was on that train way earlier than I should have been. But for six games to close out last season, boy, was I the most accurate Syracuse analyst for a little bit with regards to Barama.
He proved you right. But I think there's value in his ability to alter shots inside. And I think there's value in his rebounding. As much as I have enjoyed the play of Dolezal at the five, if you have Dolezal, both of us have Dolezal, Guerrier, and Sidibe in. Now that's a team that can rebound. I mean, Syracuse finds ways to hit shots a lot of the time, although the last two games before the break, they really didn't. But rebounding is constantly an issue for the Orange. And some of that's the nature of the zone, but some of that has to do with the personnel on the floor and the lack of Sidibe there, who you could say is maybe the third, I'd probably say the third best rebounder on the team. Although it's a kind of a toss up. So I think Sidibe needs to start games, but like both of us said, when we were talking about our lineups, the bench I think is going to incorporate in this team a lot more than it has in previous years. This is the deepest Syracuse team, definitely in the 3 years that I've gone to school at SU, and I would imagine it's probably the deepest in the 4 years that you've been there too, Owen. There's just, you know, we talk about bringing, you know, I don't have Joe and Buddy in my starting lineup. You don't have Kadari and Allen, and then there's Woody, and then there's even other guys that could come off behind them. We just haven't seen that really from an SU team in a long time. So I think regardless of what starting five goes out there, the Orange are in such better shape just with Sidibe back.
I completely agree. And when you look at the depth, I think it's sort of been since, 2015, 2016, the Final Four run as the 10 seed, that you've really had that sort of competent depth. And even that is a little bit of a stretch, because that 2015-16 team definitely had a lot to be desired with DeJuan Coleman at the five at that point. And so you could even go back a little bit further. It's been 5, 6, 7 years since they've sort of had depth in terms of competent depth, not as much in terms of Jim's going to go 8 deep here or Jim's going to go 9 deep here. I think 1 through 7 right now, in terms of, you know, Joe, Buddy, Allen, Marek, Quincy, Barama, and Kadari, you've got very, very competent and very, very capable players to come in and do their job and fill their role. And that is the sort of depth that I think Syracuse fans have been, you know, falsely asking for. I think the big cover up and the way it's been phrased is, you know, why do we only go 7 deep? Why do we only go 8 deep? But I think the concern is more along the lines of, even when you're going 7 deep, you've got guys that are really only capable of playing role minutes and sparse minutes at the end of the first half. Whereas this is sort of what they've been subliminally asking for. And it's 7 guys that can actually play and come in. And we haven't even talked about, you know, Woody Newton, who's shown flashes and ability to come in. So I think you've got your 7 guys that can play bulk minutes, can come in and change a game, can be a key player for a game. And then you've got Woody Newton as the 8, who is not incompetent and is not unable to perform, as we've seen in the early going from him. I think this is what Syracuse fans have been asking for in their weird way of critiquing Jim Boeheim for not having the depth. I think this is actually what they want, is to have this sort of depth. And that is what they do have. And it's 7 guys that can come in. And it's a good thing when you've got us two bringing out a lineup and people are questioning our lineups, which means that you've got 4, 5, 6 different lineups with these 7 guys that all hold water and different people see as what should be. It's a good sign. And it's something that I think has been the key that's sort of been holding Syracuse back, is their inability to succeed when you get into foul trouble or when someone's not playing well, or you've got to sort of rely on a guy that's struggling because there isn't another option. This year you've got options, and it's a really, really cool thing, and something that I think is probably Jim Boeheim and the Syracuse team's strongest asset.
And what a year to have this depth. I mean, if there's any year you could have picked, it's the one where guys randomly go out for 2 weeks and, you know, opponents are having random players go off the roster. There's so many options for Syracuse with the depth and the positional versatility. You know, Alan Griffin can play 2-3. I even think he could carry it up if you need him to. Quincy can play 3-4. Marek can play 4-5. Kadari can play pretty much 1-3. I mean, he played the 3 in high school. Buddy can play 2-3. There's a lot of options. So I think regardless of what goes out there, I personally don't think there's a chance on this green earth that my lineup will be the lineup that starts for Jim Boeheim. But there's so many different lineups. I could easily see it being one of ours or a multitude of things because of the different combinations that Jim can put together when SU takes on Pitt.
And they get a little bit more into Pitt. I mean, there are, Syracuse has had their issues with the COVID pandemic, and so has Pitt. And Pitt, unfortunately for them, has had its biggest issue not being COVID related with the injury to Justin Champagne, a foot injury or a leg injury, I believe it is, out 6 to 8 weeks. And that is something that obviously no one wants to see, but the 6 to 8 week injury is something that will definitely hurt them. And it's a Pitt team that has shown some competence. And to sort of, you know, add on to the spiral, Jeff Capel said that even beyond Champagne, there will not be a full roster for Syracuse and Pitt and that they will be missing 2 to 3 more guys for this game. So to detail who in theory will be there and some of the things that Pitt has to offer and the different aspects of this Pitt Panthers squad, we caught up with Craig Meyer of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette to really delve into what this team has to offer, if much at this point. We now welcome on Craig Meyer of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Craig, it's been a crazy few weeks for both the Syracuse and the Pitt programs, but there's a game scheduled for tomorrow. We're both back on the court, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about. So thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate having you today.
I appreciate y'all thinking of me for this. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. Just checking in. How's everything inside the personal circle? Things going all right, COVID wise?
Yeah, things are good. I'm thankful I haven't tested positive. My wife hasn't tested positive. You know, I've known people who have, and yeah, it's certainly a trying ordeal. Some of them have fared better than others as far as the severity of their symptoms, but otherwise, yeah, done well. I mean, I guess it's been about 10 months here. So, mostly just been kind of hunkered down here, taking all of the necessary precautions and, staying safe and trying to stay as sane as possible, which I guess can be a little bit trickier.
Yes, the balance of safety and sanity is something that we're all working on right now. And it's something that, you know, for Syracuse and Pitt, and Syracuse is, I mean, they've got players that are finishing up their third round of a 14-day quarantine, and Pitt's coming off a quarantine themselves. How do you think these sort of, you know, extended times off will play into these guys coming back on the court? What do you think you'll be seeing? A little bit of a lag early going?
Yeah, I almost don't know how this doesn't impact them. Syracuse's last game was December 19th, Pitt's was December 22nd. And throughout this whole time, I mean, Syracuse, as you all know, they've had 3 postponements during that time. Pitt has had 2. And even in Pitt's case, like their first one against Duke, so that game was on December 29th, or it was set to be played on December 29th. Pitt was on the bus on the way to the airport on December 28th when they got a call notifying them of a positive test, and they turned around. So, I mean, you're mentally preparing yourself and making these logistical plans, I guess, for these games. And then in a lot of cases, or in several cases here recently, they just don't end up happening. They get pushed back. And Pitt, to that point, hadn't had a whole lot of uncertainty with their season. They had played 7 games. They had all gone relatively normally. They had dealt with some injuries, but those are things, I guess as callous as it can be to say that teams deal with over the course of any normal season anyway. So things had been fairly normal for them. But over these past few weeks, I mean, I don't see how it doesn't impact them in some way, where there's all this uncertainty and where you have all of these games scheduled, but you have no idea really until a couple of days before they're taking place, whether they're actually going to happen. And when you haven't played for several weeks and your practice and workout schedules are altered while contact tracing and quarantining takes place. Yeah, I think even a normal break, say that they hadn't played a game for 3 weeks and they were just practicing and doing all of their normal workouts, I think even that would have an impact for the first game back. And given all of the other circumstances, I expect Wednesday's game to be a little bit, a little bit odd, I guess, sort of an accurate reflection of this time that we're living in.
It's obviously been an interesting time for both Pitt and Syracuse, but also the people who cover them, like yourself. How has that been affected, not only during this layoff of 2 weeks for Pittsburgh, but the whole season just with COVID protocols and everything?
It's definitely been weird. I mean, I remembered being at the ACC tournament last year. This, I guess, was March 10th and 11th. So it was the day before and the day of that everything kind of shut down, because on the 11th, that didn't, Rudy Gobert's positive test didn't arise until that night. So Pitt had played 2 games in the tournament that day. And it was odd because you would see news coverage of like, oh, the governor of the state of North Carolina has declared a state of emergency. but you would still have like, you know, 10,000 people in the arena in Greensboro for these games. And then it got to the point where it's like, okay, there are no more fans for the final three or four days of the tournament. And then on the 12th, they were planning on playing games, but it got shut down then. But from a media standpoint, it was odd then when it was like, okay, you don't get locker room access. Like you have to talk to these guys in kind of a mixed zone type area. And now it's just, I mean, and very understandably, I mean, we talked to players and coaches via Zoom. Pitt's been playing in an empty arena here for their past several games. Their first few, there were basically family members of players and coaches, and then high level boosters too were physically like present there, but even they're not allowed there anymore. So you can kind of hear a little bit more. You can hear what coaches and players say. I had underestimated how much players say "and one" over the course of the game. Pretty much anytime that they take a shot, I feel like they think they've been fouled. But that part's been odd, and you do feel a little bit detached. Like college athletics anyway. It's very sanitized. Like access is very controlled. But I feel like even less so. To the extent that I do feel like I get to know these guys a bit, I feel like that's been taken away a bit this year. And obviously, again, for very understandable reasons, but even for road games, I'll for some of them, I'll be traveling to Syracuse, but other ones, I just watch them on TV, and I'm not really comfortable flying now. So that'll end up limiting the number of road games I'll potentially cover. But again, it's just an odd, unconventional season during, and I guess to put it very lightly, an odd, unconventional time.
Yeah, 100%. It's been absolutely crazy, these changes. And as you were saying, absolutely rightfully so, but a lot of different changes that you're making, that we're making, that we're all making. But here we are. We got basketball to cover for the first time in 2 weeks. And unfortunately, on Pitt's side of the ball, one of the early bright spots and really looked phenomenal through the first handful of games, and Justin Champagny is going to be out for 6 to 8 weeks. So what kind of loss does that sort of bring to the table, and what can Pitt sort of do in terms of replacing that 17.5 points and 12 plus rebounds per game? How do you go about replacing that production?
I guess the simple answer to it is there really is no way to do to replace him in terms of his production and then what he does for that team. I mean, he was someone who a couple of weeks, or I guess it was probably actually about a week before he got injured, he had put up back-to-back games with at least 20 points and 20 rebounds. I mean, he's someone who just is such an instinctual and, I guess, productive rebounder, and just an overall player too. He's someone who seems to always be in the right place at the right time. And I don't mean that in any kind of way, trying to say that he's a lucky, like that's a skill to me. And he's someone who really possesses that and exemplifies it. And against a team like Syracuse, he would have been so helpful for him because, against that 2-3 zone, he's someone who, given his height and his skill set, you could work out of the high post really well. He lurks along the baseline. That's kind of where he makes his living quite a bit, just kind of operating along there. Those are soft spots in that zone. And he would have been someone who offensively could have really allowed him to kind of capitalize on some of the few things that Syracuse does offer you. There really isn't a way to replace him too. It's just tough where as far as what he does, even with rebounding, I don't even think you can put two guys there to fully replicate what he does. I mean, it'd take three guys. I mean, he's averaging about 13 rebounds a game, and it's just a really unfortunate injury for them because they were 5-1 coming off a 15-point win at Miami. Grant, Miami was dealing with some injury problems, but it seemed like, they had beaten Northwestern previously, and Northwestern was a ranked team for 1 week there. And it seemed like things were really on the upswing for him. And that injury comes, and you're going to be without your best player for 2 months here. And I guess if there is one silver lining with the COVID related postponements, it's that those are potentially one or two fewer games that that they'll have to play without him. But yeah, it's a really it's a devastating loss for that team, and I guess for a program that's really trying to rebuild itself.
Replacing his points, replacing his rebounds, as you said, a tall task, but someone's going to take up the shots in the minutes that Champagne was taking for sure. Tony and Johnson come to mind, the second and third leading scorers behind Champagne. Is there a third guy that maybe steps up and gets a lot more of the ball and maybe a lot more minutes than he did previously?
Yeah, that's a kind of the key question for Pitt right now, you know, and I guess it's almost two different tasks, you know, that they've got here. They've got to, you know, as far as a third scorer here, I mean, that was even when he was healthy, they were desperately looking for a fourth scorer where, you know, you had had Champagne and Tony and Johnson, all of whom were averaging 14, 15 a game at least. The next closest guy was averaging about seven and a half. So this wasn't a team with a ton of scoring depth. The two most likely guys, I think, to fill that role would be Ithiel Horton and Nike Sabandi, both shooting guards, probably the team's two best outside shooters. And this is a team that the past couple years, you know, or at the very least last year, didn't have really a reliable outside shooter. So those would be two guys who I think could fill the scoring void a bit. As far as Champagne's minutes, so I think it'll be a bit of a group effort. I think that you'll have to lean some on some of the team's freshmen like William Jeffress and Noah Collier. I think Pitt will ultimately end up having to get a little experimental with their lineups, maybe having ones with both of the team's point guards, Xavier Johnson and Femi Odukale, on the court at the same time, and then potentially also having, you know, some lineups there where Audie's Tony at 6'6" is kind of like the de facto power forward. I think they're just going to have to tinker a lot and see what works, because I mean, yeah, this is a problem they're going to be dealing with for at least the next month here.
I saw your article from the other day, and it was just like, here's, we don't know what the situation's going to be, but here's basically 10 lineups that you might see or could work or could be the answer. And Ben and I were having that discussion with Syracuse the other day as Baramas Adebay comes back and you've sort of figured some things out. And now you're back into the situation where who should be playing, what should the lineup be, where should the minutes come. And in a season like this, it seems like there are going to be a lot of teams in situations like that. And obviously, you know, with the loss of Champagne, an unforeseen, you never want to see a guy get hurt. And when you're assuming missing time this year, unfortunately, it is due to COVID reasons. But one of the guys that you just sort of mentioned and a guy that I've been having some small conversations about that we're just sort of not really sure how good he actually is right now is Ithiel Horton. And he comes in as a transfer and has played all right in the early going. But as you mentioned, with Champagne out, it's going to come to a little bit more production and you're going to look to him a little bit more. How good is he? What have you sort of seen out of him in the early going?
Yeah, with him, it's been interesting. So his first few games there, it was a struggle for him. He wasn't getting up a lot of shots. When he was getting up shots, he was shooting from three in the low 30% range. And with him, it's tough because he's basically there to be a shooter for them. He does some other stuff offensively a little bit. He can occasionally score off the dribble, but defensively he's not a very good player. So pretty much he is there to be a three-point shooter for them. And he's had a couple games where he really showed flashes of it against, I think it was Northern Illinois. He had kind of broken out of an early season slump, and I think a lot of people, maybe not the more irrational fans, but I think some people kind of recognize the fact that, okay, you're a transfer. You sat out all of last year. These are the first games you've played in a year and a half. Like, I get that things are going to be very rusty for you. That you can't just, that you can maybe make a bunch of threes in practice and that impresses teammates and coaches, but games are an entirely different situation. And he had struggled with that a little bit, and coaches have been, they've talked a lot about how he had put a lot of pressure on himself. He's got some perfectionist tendencies, and he's a guy who really just wants to do so well for his team that he ultimately ends up burdening himself with a little bit too much pressure, you know, and this kind of desire to prove his worth and make every shot he takes. He's had a couple breakout games. Yeah, he had the Northern Illinois game. He played really well against against Miami. I think he had 18 in that game and was a big reason why Pitt was able to pull away in the second half there. So I guess so far he's been relatively streaky, which for Pitt isn't great. You would hope for someone, you know, he had shot 40% or about 41% from three as his freshman season at Delaware. Pitt would gladly take anything like that. I mean, they would even take a guy who shoots in the high 30s. But I do wonder how effective he'll ultimately be for the team. Say he shoots 38% from three for the year. That's great. But if that 38% comes because there'll be three or four games where he'll shoot 28%, then he'll have one game where he goes 5 of 9 from three. That's something that I ultimately think isn't helpful for Pitt. I think he'll need to be someone who's more consistent, who can regularly knock down those shots to kind of diversify that team's offense and keep opposing defenses honest. Because really what teams did a lot, especially last year, was Pitt didn't have great outside shooting. So it wouldn't even just be Syracuse throwing zones at him. It would be teams that rarely played zone. They would throw that 3-2 or 2-3 zone or even a 1-3-1 at him, and Pitt would just be completely flummoxed. So if he can regularly knock down shots, he can keep opposing defenses a little bit more honest.
A 2-3 zone will definitely be present in this game. And as you said, Pitt's had some trouble knocking down shots over this season and the last one. One guy that's been pretty solid for them so far is Adiz Toney, who's the second leading scorer and right now the healthiest leading scorer on this Pitt roster. He's shooting nearly 41% through the first six games. It's not on a million attempts, but it's on a healthy number of attempts. Could you see him maybe ramping up the number of three-point shots he takes to try and supplement some of that outside shooting?
I could potentially see it, yeah. I mean, he's their best three-point shooter this year. I guess part of me wonders how sustainable it is because he, you know, he's someone who, I want to say last year, I think he shot about 32, 33% from three. He's shooting about 40% this year. I undoubtedly think that he has improved as a shooter. I just don't know if it's necessary to that extent. But yeah, he'll be someone I think that they'll count on. And I mean, he's really improved his total offensive game. I mean, that was something we saw a little bit from him toward the end of last season. He seemed to take on more of an offensive role for them. Up to that point in his career, he had been kind of more of a, I don't even want to say like a defensive specialist, but he was the team's best defender. He would typically be, you know, he would typically be put on the opposing team's best offensive player, assuming that guy wasn't like a 6'10 center. But he was offensively more of a complimentary player. He'd be the team's fourth, maybe fifth leading scorer. But he's certainly taken on a more active role this year, a more central role in terms of what Pitt does offensively. He's been good off the dribble. He's finished pretty well around the rim and transition. He, you know, he's just someone that's typically streaking out that they look for. So I think that what we've seen from him, I don't know if his numbers will stay the same, but especially with Justin Champagne out here, he's certainly someone they'll be leaning on more. And I'm intrigued to see how capable he is to kind of handle that increased load. And I'm curious not only to see if he can do well with that, but if in turn the team can do well with him, because last season when his production really ramped up in the final month or a month and a half of the season, the team's fortunes really took a dive. I don't think that was because of him. I think it was more coincidental, but I will be intrigued to see if that individual statistical performances can come with some wins for Pitt.
Yeah. One of the other sort of just overarching questions that I had regarding this team is when you sort of look at the stats for this squad from top to bottom in the early going, there have been a lot of guys that have seen the court at different points in different, obviously, you know, chunks of time. Are there any sort of overachievers that you've seen so far? Who has came in and exceeded expectations in the early going so far?
I would say Audis Tenney is certainly one of them. I had expected, I guess, some love improvement from him, but I mean, he's someone who's, you know, averaging about 7 more points per game than he did last year. He's from about 9 to a 16 here now. So he's someone. I think otherwise, Abdul Karim Coulibaly, who's been the team's primary starter at the 5 spot this year. He's improved a lot from where he was as a freshman. He seems a little more confident, a little bit more together. His game seems a little bit more refined. So he would be somebody else. Among the freshmen, William Jeffress has been good for him. You know, his numbers don't pop up a bunch, but he's a top 100 recruit from the 2020 class. And my main concern with him, and you know, it gets brought up on broadcasts all the time, I'm sure probably will be tomorrow, is he's only 17, you know, and he turned 17 back in June. So he's someone who reclassified, skipped, like he had the requisite credits to be able to graduate high school year early, but he was even young for his grades. So I was just intrigued, or I guess maybe a little bit skeptical, that someone that young could really step in and physically handle college basketball and everything, you know, and everything that it offers and demands. But I think he's done a pretty good job with it. So I would say those three guys would probably qualify as my biggest surprises so far this year.
Coulibaly against Sidibe. It'll be two guys from the same city in Mali going up against each other next game. That should be fun. Pittsburgh, you know, it's been an interesting start to the year. Before the, you know, extended COVID break, there was the opening night loss to St. Francis, but then the 5-game win streak, including the big Northwestern win and a dominant Miami performance. Champagne gets hurt, the Louisville loss. You know, what do you feel the expectations are for Pitt as a whole this season? What do people think the team can do? And maybe what does the team think the team can do?
It's definitely been a roller coaster. You had touched on it there. Going into the season, I think that there was a general hope that this team can finish above 500, which is no small feat, for it hasn't done that since the 2015-2016 season. With that, assuming there, you know, if there is any kind of an NIT this year, that they could hopefully qualify for that. But then after the St. Francis game, I mean, it was panic. It was like, this team may not be any good. And you're at a point in Jeff Capel's tenure where it's your third year. He took over, you know, as he has said before, a dumpster fire. That's a program that the year before he got there was 8-24 overall, 0-19 in the ACC. And it not only lost those games, I mean, it got blown out in them. I mean, I think its average margin of defeat in ACC games was like 12 or 13 points that year. So he took over a program in bad shape. They had a 6-win improvement his first year. Then they improved on that by 2 wins the following year, which was a little bit of a disappointment. And I think going into this year, the thought was, okay, well, now it's time to make that next step to get above 500, make a postseason of some kind. And after the St. Francis one, that certainly didn't look like it was going to be the case. And you had some more existential questions about, okay, what is this program possibly capable of under him? But they've rebounded from that. They had won those 5 straight games. So they were 5-1. They just beat Miami by 15. I think the thought then, like, you would maybe even get some people be like, this could be an NCAA tournament team. We have a young star in Justin Champagne. The ACC doesn't look all that good. And then you get the news that he's out for 6 to 8 weeks. And I think that completely changes expectations. And I guess the way that people calibrate what would be a successful season or kind of measure that. So I think in some ways we're almost back to where we were going into the season, where I think people hope for the best, that they can finish 500 or better, and that they won't be without Champagne for too long. You know, at least if games keep getting postponed, and you know, there was an injury scare with him going into his freshman year where they thought he might be out a while. Turned out he didn't miss any time. So I guess that there's some hope too that he may be able to come back earlier in that time frame.
One final question here. We've got a big game tomorrow. The return for both of these schools after, you know, 2+ weeks apiece off. What is the key for Pitt to get a win and to sort of, you know, continue the decent trajectory that they had going in the early portion of the season?
I'll probably cop out here and just say outside shooting. I mean, if they can get someone like Ithiel Horton and Xavier Johnson and Audis Toney really going from deep, because I don't think that without Champagne they're going to get a ton of production down low. I think if they can shoot fairly well from the outside and not go on any sort of long scoring droughts, I mean, because that's really what's doomed them a lot of, you know, against Syracuse, especially in the Carrier Dome, where I think each of their past 3 or 4 games there, they've had a scoring drought of at least like 5 or 6 minutes. And I feel like in those moments, they've panicked a little bit. And I think this team, you know, where of their 10 rotation players, 4 of them are freshmen, I think they would be prone to that. I think that might be the biggest key for them. Aside from that, I think that would probably be it. Cause I just think that, I don't think that you're going to get someone to replace what Justin Champagne does. So, yeah, it's kind of a simplistic answer, but just knock down some outside shots, stretch that zone a little bit, and, you know, maybe find someone. It would probably be Audis Toney who can work well and kind of operate out of that high post.
You saw it a little bit last season when Pitt came to the Dome. Audis Toney was thriving a little bit over at the high post, and that's sort of where you're going to live and die against the zone for a lot of these approaches. Craig, thank you so much for taking the time today. Safe trip up. I think you said you were making the trip, so safe travels tomorrow, and have a safe rest of the season as well.
Thank you, guys, and same to you.
One last thank you to Craig Meyer of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette diving into that, you know, sort of dilapidated Pittsburgh team at this point and sort of trying to find the answers to a similar discussion that Ben and I have been having for some time in terms of who the hell is starting in this basketball game. Because I think on both sides, Pittsburgh and Syracuse, neither squad really knows who the starting five are going to be when they trot out onto the court tomorrow. But it's the return to Syracuse basketball beyond Pittsburgh. And so we're going to look a little bit more expansive at this sort of 5-game stretch over the next 2 weeks for Syracuse, which now includes 2 games against Pittsburgh, the rivalry game against a pretty crummy Georgetown squad, a good Clemson team, and then Miami, who has dealt with some injuries of their own and who Pitt beat earlier in this season. So you got a 5-game stretch. It goes Pitt, Georgetown, Clemson, Pitt, Miami. What are the expectations? What do you need to do in this stretch?
I think the expectation is that 4 games are won. I mean, I think Pittsburgh is a team that SU should handle pretty well, Georgetown especially. And Miami is decent, but they have a lot of injuries too. So I think that's another one SU should handle. It's Clemson on the 12th that I think is the most interesting game when you look at it from a competitive standpoint. Clemson's the 18th ranked team in the country, according to KenPom. They're playing really good basketball. But I'm going to say I think Syracuse needs to win all 5. It's a lofty expectation, but if we're breaking this up into 5-game stretches, that's a very winnable 5-game stretch with probably 4 or 5 wins in it for SU. The next 5-game stretch is Virginia Tech, Virginia, NC State, Louisville, and then Clemson again, this time on the road instead of at home. So I think given the toughness of the second half of the season, you know, Syracuse really got a really, really harsh back half of the schedule. SU needs to pile up as many wins as possible in the front end. I think they can win all 5 games, and beating Clemson at home, I think they should win all 5 games if they have, you know, the tournament aspirations that they want to capture this season.
I think it's sort of been the narrative of the last, you know, handful of seasons. It seems like Syracuse has been consistently getting these back heavy, back loaded schedules. And to some degree, it's an advantage, but to another degree, you sort of have to have your ducks in a row in these early games, because if you've got things to figure out in the early going of the ACC slate and you've got a backloaded schedule, then you're not able to sort of rack up those wins in the early going and be able to afford some conference losses later on. I think obviously you want to go 5-0, and because you're playing the home and home with Clemson, you want to win this game at home. I mean, it's an easier game to win at home naturally, obviously a little bit different this year. A Little John's a tough place to play, and you don't want to have to be needing your one win against Clemson in that game that is on the road. You have to go 4-1 here. You have to go 4-1 here. I don't care if it includes a bad loss and a win against Clemson. You cannot lose two games in this stretch. It is as vital as anything right now for Syracuse basketball is to come out of this stretch with four wins, because that is, I mean, to get to 10-2 gives you a lot of versatility moving forward, and it gives you a lot of opportunities as you move on in this season and in this game. And it's something when you sort of look at the KenPom charts right now, Syracuse is projected to win its next seven, which is something that I think everyone would want to see and something that you can really build off of. But this is a vital stretch. You've got to get your work done against Pittsburgh twice. This is not anymore a good Pittsburgh team. It was a decent Pittsburgh team. With the loss of Champagne, it's not a good Pittsburgh team anymore. And it's a team that you should be able to win twice against with relative ease, I'm going to say. Georgetown is not good this year. You need to win that game. Clemson is the toss-up. Clemson is the toss-up. You've got to find a way to be competitive against Clemson. But I think it is more than survivable if you drop that game against Clemson. If you fall in any of these other games, that's where the issue arises. And if you go 3-2 in this stretch, that is a drastic issue that is going to be tough to come back from, as we mentioned, with this backloaded second half of the schedule.
You mentioned the KenPom projection, and maybe that falls into part of the reason that I say the Orange need to win all five. You know, KenPom has Syracuse projected to go 10-7 in the conference. I happen to think that while they could make it otherwise, going above 500 in conference play is the best way for SU to assure that they're in the tournament, don't have to play a play-in game, and have it at least somewhat comfortably and relative to Syracuse terms, who seem to slip in at the last second all the time. If you drop the Clemson game, there's not a lot of room for error, because KenPom's picking Syracuse to beat Virginia Tech once, beat NC State once, beat Louisville once, and beat North Carolina once. So it's just the reason I think you got to win all five is, I don't know, you know, maybe the loss that KenPom projects SU's going to have to NC State on the road in February, maybe that's a more winnable game than Clemson at home. But there's a small margin for error if you are trying to go above 500 in the conference, which I think should be Syracuse's goal. So they can survive it. If the Clemson game goes the Tigers' way, I'm not going to say, oh, Syracuse's season is over, let's pack up for the NIT if there is one. But then, you know, you start to grind your teeth at every game, because the earlier they pick up the losses, the more perfect SU has to be down the stretch. And this just typically isn't a team that reels off tons of big win streaks. They'll beat someone they shouldn't and then lose to someone they shouldn't all the time. So I think the first big, big win of the season for Syracuse should be Clemson on January 12th.
Agreed. They had a chance to beat a good Rutgers team early on. And fortunately for Syracuse, that Rutgers loss is looking fine right now. Rutgers up to 19 in KenPom. That's a good basketball team, a reputable loss at this point. But you've got a clutch five-game stretch, an important five-game stretch going up and starting tomorrow. And it's something that you're going to need to hold on to. We're into the bulk of the ACC slate. Obviously, one non-con game left, even though it is a crummy Georgetown team this year. Obviously, eyes will be on that game like normal. I believe it was just put into the ESPN2 game at 8 o'clock, so it'll be a primetime game and a game with a national audience. So something to look into in terms of that game, but it's a game you've got to win, and it's a five-game stretch where Syracuse has got to win games. We're excited. It's the ACC time. It means our predictions graphics are coming back over at Ostrom Avenue Pod Twitter. not to flex, but Owen is 3-0 and Ben is simply 2-1 at this point.
You've got to hold on to that 3-0 for way too long.
Yeah.
One game.
It's amazing. I got, you know, two bonus weeks of being undefeated and never having lost in our predictions pool. But the ACC predictions will continue. Let us know your thoughts on that over at Ostrom Avenue Pod Twitter. And we're going to start cranking episodes out because this is a pretty action-packed two-week span where there's going to be a lot to talk about. And, you know, with everything else going on, you know, you hope that the storylines stick to basketball at this point. So while that does, so will we. For Ben Shulman, I'm Owen Valentine. This has been the Ostrom Avenue Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. Stay safe.